Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. It's the first podcast of 2018. It's the second, I think, of January. And Anna and myself have had a bit of a break. We've been taking it easy. We've felt the need to take it easy, really, but 2017 was pretty crazy. And I did find that I was quite tired and just needed to stop. And anyway, we're hopefully now back on track with everything, and hopefully we can get a good program of podcasts on a variety of subjects out to you for 2018. One thing we have been doing is getting sort of geekish about cryptocurrency and blockchain technology and all that kind of stuff, which I've had my eye on since it came out. I've always liked to keep a bit of an eye on technology, particularly IT. And been fascinated by it. And I was kind of in on the internet in the days of dial-up modems and stuff like that. And I think if I'd have had a bit more money, I might have been in on it a bit earlier. It's just kind of fascinating. And I do have a question that I've lived with since childhood, really, around the way in which the unfolding of history and the way in which a society develops and an economy develops and the way in which the things people do change is related to the technological advancements that happen. And you can go right the way back into prehistory and envisage the first time somebody utilised fire, for instance, or first time somebody made a spear, for instance. And we can come a bit further down the line, you know, and think of what changes came about because of the development of the plough, or a sailing boat that could take on the open ocean, and so on and so on and so on. And it's not that far back that people were experimenting with transportation that didn't rely on animals, or Shanks's pony. First of all, with steam cars and steam locomotives and so on, you know, which were a development upon static steam engines used to pump water out of mines, going back to, I suppose, the 18th century, which was a kind of a bit of a turning point vis-a-vis mechanical invention. And a lot of this stuff was built on the science that came out of Newton. Newton's laws of motions, which in their turn were built upon the mathematical innovations of people like René Descartes. So, I'm saying not that long ago that was all going on. The 18th century, you know, it's not that long. It's not actually that long ago in world terms. Certainly in my grandfather's life, when my grandfather was a young man, well, both my grandfathers, in fact, you know, even though the one was quite a bit older than the other, lived in a time when there were no cars, no aeroplanes, no telephones, you know, or very few telephones, maybe three telephones in the country or something. And you know, I'm not that ancient, but when I was a kid, the bread and the milk was delivered by a chap on a cart with a horse. So, that, I mean, it's within living memory, the changes have been absolutely phenomenal and speeding up. Now, there is a philosophical stroke, sociological stroke, cultural studies, stroke economics question around to what extent is technological development a driver of history? And this is something that I'm wanting to spend a little bit of time on, finding out what people have said about this. Now I'm aware, you know, that there are schools that think that it's the technological development is everything. And there are schools, particularly Marxists, you know, who want to deny that and say that, well, prior to that is the logic of capital. And you can see how it does make sense, it fits, to see that capitalist enterprises are in competition with each other. So you've got two manufacturers of aeroplanes, and they're probably paying the same price for their raw materials, more or less. Probably paying more or less the same price for their labour. And how is the one going to get a bigger market share than the other? Or even more pressing, perhaps, how is the other not going to be put out of business if the other is a superior competitor in some way? So there's competition, basically, isn't there? You know, the capitalist setup relies on competition. And even capitalist economists think that, well, competition itself is the driver of innovation. Well, they trot that out as a part of their propaganda for the superiority of their economic system. Certainly, we'll look into that in a bit. So, if you make an innovation, if aircraft company A makes an innovation that enables them to get more productivity out of the labour whilst paying the same price for it, maybe with a bit of mechanisation or something, or maybe they can use, maybe they have a design or a piece of technology that comes out that speeds up the production process, or means that you use cheaper or less materials in the plane itself, whatever. So you've got a couple of things there that can give you a competitive edge, you know, or a few things that can give you a competitive edge. You can see there how a competitive edge can come if company A gets a technological innovation that company B doesn't get. And it's because of this possibility that, of course, we have the whole phenomenon of industrial espionage, patents, which allow you to prevent somebody from copying your invention so you can capitalise on it. And all of these legal frameworks, like patent law and so forth, are part of the legal apparatus that allows competition to do what it purports to do, which is deliver innovation and cheap and good products that the public want and need. Ha! Well, so much for the free market. You know, you can see how immediately regulation comes in. I mean, just on the matter of patent law and so forth. But you can see that is the kind of story you might tell that gives quite a bit of primacy in the way the economy unfolds to technological innovation per se, and that everything else would follow from that, you know, like living patterns, culture, the way we live vis-a-vis such basics as transport, shopping, agriculture, blah blah, the whole kind of caboodle. But you can also see how that underneath that is, you say, the logic of capital. The logic of capital is that you have to grow. You have to expand beyond your competition. If you don't grow, you don't make profits. Profits become stagnant, and so forth. Of course, you know, according to the Marxists, and according to the law, in fact, you know, corporate profits, the bottom line, is the legal, as well as the logical requirement of a capitalist enterprise. So there's questions around that. My own thought is, as ever, dialectical. In some respect, in the, I see interactions, and also I see unique circumstances for particular industries at particular times in particular places, which bring in other formative forces, if I can use a sloppy word like that. So there is a question about that, and I do in the future, if I get any time, want to take a look. So there's my interest in blockchain, Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, IT in general, computers in general. So it poses some philosophical stroke economic or philosophy of economics questions for me. Now, what was exciting about Bitcoin when I first encountered it was just simply being able to decentralise. Was being able to have a very rational and simplified means of exchange that didn't require third parties. Now, Bitcoin was invented in 2009. I think the white paper came out then, written by the pseudonymous Satoshi Nakamoto. And it was, in many ways, a response to the 2008 banking crisis that pretty well plunged the world into the biggest financial crisis since 1929. Now, this was a scam if ever there was one. And it's a scam perpetrated by the middlemen. And it seems they knew what they were doing, because they shorted the collapse, a lot of them, and made lots of money by doing that. Not only that, they repossessed, certainly in the US, at least 10 million people who'd been conned into having subprime mortgages through predatory lending. So a lot of people had their houses possessed. The banks then sold the houses to interests that rented those houses back out to a now homeless population for high rents. And the owners of the debt, the collateralised debt options, which was this kind of funny money, these derivatives, instruments, which had been fraudulently rated by Moody's and so on as being AAA, totally dependable debt options, which are in fact like shit debt, subprime mortgage debt. They cried wolf and said, "Oh man, we've been busted by this." So they got the taxpayers to bail them out, apart from Lehman Brothers, Northern Rock, Bank of Scotland, and all the big American banks all got bailed out with taxpayers' money. And funny money printed, quantitative easing, which of course undermined the system further. And Goldman Sachs, for instance, made absolute fortune. Absolute fortune. So this was a kind of a three-way win-win, you know, getting compensated for the crap mortgages that you'd sold and packaged into these fucking dodgy instruments, which also served the function of covering the tracks of what exactly was going on. Getting bailed out by taxpayers. And then making money selling the repossessed property or renting the repossessed property at very high rents. Fucking hell. And nobody went to jail. A few people got fined. They got fined small change for banks. Anyway, Satoshi Nakamoto, I thought, fuck me, this is no good. There's got to be a better way of exchange, of having some kind of token of exchange, some medium of exchange. And wrote the Bitcoin white paper. I thought, well, can we have electronic money that works on a ledger system and that can handle ledgers that can't be falsified? Immutable ledgers. Immutable public ledger is basically what Bitcoin is. It's an immutable public ledger of which there are thousands and thousands of copies which have to agree with each other in order for a transaction to be deemed valid. they have to actually check in many, many copies of a ledger that the person wanting to withdraw some funds and send it somewhere else actually has got the funds. So, sweet idea. And could it be done on computers? Now a lot of people call this kind of magic internet money. Well, they don't realise that all money is magic internet money. Fiat money is magic internet money. Dollars, pounds, euros, yen. All this. At least, I think it's 95%, but certainly over 90% of the money in circulation exists only as bits and bytes on a hard drive somewhere. You know, on an electronic ledger. Banks keep electronic ledgers. But these are ledgers which they have control, and these are ledgers which can be therefore rewritten. You can't rewrite the Bitcoin ledger. The whole point is that you can't rewrite it. The point of a bank ledger is you can rewrite it. And this is why governments have been able to give people's banks, bank accounts haircuts, as they did in Cyprus not so long ago. And as they did in Greece, basically. You know? Money as we have it, fiat money as we have it, it's very easily manipulated by governments and financial, large powerful financial institutions to take money out of people's accounts and pensions and so forth, one way or the other. Even if it's only by inflation. So, Satoshi Nakamoto was alert to the scam-like nature of our current monetary systems, which had brought the world to its knees economically. So, your ordinary money in the bank there, it is just bits and bytes on the bank's computer systems. And if you go to the bank and they say, do you want to borrow some money, like they say to me every time I go in, and if you said yes, and what they do is they will actually just type in a figure into the plus column of your account. That's it. That's where that money comes from. And the bank has a sort of license to do that. From the government and the central bank through some kind of weird jiggery-pokery with bonds and lending and stuff like that, which maybe I'll go into some time. But the upshot of it is that your money, your ordinary money, your pound notes and so forth, is fucking, it's magic internet money, I'm afraid, it's magic computer money. And it's a lot less sensible and rational than actually the idea that Satoshi Nakamoto came up with. Now, a lot hinges here on what exactly is the nature of money. And it's one of those questions with several reasonably plausible answers. But my own thought here is that in a utopia, they hadn't quite managed to abandon money yet. All you need is a very reliable and trustworthy ledger that enables you to transfer value quickly and cheaply anywhere on the planet. And this is the thing that they don't like. You can transfer it anywhere on the planet. It's funny internet money. And you don't need to rely on banks. And so on and so forth. Well, I was kind of quite thrilled by that idea when Bitcoin came out. And I did experiment with it. And I wanted to see if I could buy something, you know. And I got some Bitcoin, which I bought off somebody over the internet and stuck it in a Bitcoin wallet. And I bought it for some pound, you know, some fiat money, pounds. Very cheap at the time. And I knew people were saying, oh, they were mining Bitcoin on their laptop. And they'd got 100 Bitcoin on their hard drive, you know. Looking for a few cents each, you know. So, and because they were actually like geeks playing with the technology, which is basically what I was doing. But I did have a big question about exchange, about the exchange of value, and about trade and about markets. And this is a part of a kind of a utopian thinking, plus a kind of historical thinking about the development of the economic side of human life. And all this was to do with my desire for some kind of peaceful revolution that would make the world a better place and a more peaceful place in which more people could prosper and live long and happy lives. I actually want that for some weird reason. So, you know, I was putting my philosophical acumen, as poor as it is, to bear on this matter of exchange and what it is and how can it be improved. And so, yeah, I was thrilled by Nakamoto's white paper. And then when Ethereum came along, that idea seemed even more explosive, potentially, which is the idea that, well, as well as just transferring value, or having a ledger, an immutable ledger, distributed ledger, which basically just carries some numbers, some values, and does a few basic calculations, subtractions, additions, and so forth, that you can actually stick anything programmable in there. If you could mount a programmable language, it's called technically a Turing complete language, onto a blockchain, so you could have automated contracts, stores of identity, something like, say, a land registry, which would be absolutely invaluable in the third world where they don't have them, and which means that governments and corporations can take people's small family farms away from them because they want to mine diamonds or something like that, you know. So it seemed like there was this huge expansion in the possibilities of this technology. As I say, I tried to buy something and it worked fine. I bought a little bit of tech equipment from a company that said they'd take Bitcoin. And funnily, this company supplies the Queen, it has a royal warrant to supply the Queen with high-performance computers. So I was thinking, oh well, because you even think, well, is this even legal, you know? And you say, well, if these guys work for the Queen and they're willing to take Bitcoin to buy a little piece of equipment, no need to worry. And there it was, it came in the post the next day. It was as easy as shopping on Amazon and all the rest of it, and it didn't cost very much, and so on and so forth. But this was a few years ago, you know, and I kind of got this little bit of Bitcoin sitting there, and some little bits of Ethereum and this kind of stuff, and I would like have a little study every now and then without getting too frenzied about it. And I don't know, over last year, this little tiny little bit of money started to become like a useful amount of money. And you think, well, I haven't done it. This is preposterous, you know. She's like money coming out of thin air, you know. So we've been Anna and myself have been taking like a deeper look, so that we can kind of get somewhere to live and not have to pay rent over the next year or two. Anyway, that's where we've been at, and that's kind of the story behind that. But one certainly realises that it's in its infancy. I mean, Bitcoin, now that everybody wants some, is now really hitting problems of scalability. When it was a few geeks, it was fine with its 4 transactions a second. Bear in mind that something like Visa and MasterCard do tens of thousands of transactions per second, and Bitcoin can manage about 4 or 5 or something like that. Ethereum's a bit faster, maybe it's 10, I don't know. But, you know, there are problems with the technology. I suppose if we were talking steam engines, it'd be something like the move would have been made from the first steam engines, which were stationary and used to pump water out of mines, to somebody getting the bright idea of sticking wheels on. So you can go down the road with it, with a bloke standing in front of you holding a red flag, because the government panics and puts a 4-mile-an-hour speed limit on it. So we're kind of at that stage, I think. You know, and the tech problems, now that there's a scalability and an excitement and a moving into the mainstream. This is bringing to light the technological limitations that need to be overcome. And of course, there are, to my mind, some of the smartest people on the planet are working on overcoming these various problems. You know, having a system that will bank the unbanked. Or in a sense, you know, where people in Africa and Asia, who, and maybe parts of South America, who very commonly have these days have a mobile phone and access to a mobile phone network, But no banking. There's billions of people on the planet who have no access to financial services. They can't get loans, they can't pay the bills very easily. And it really is kind of cramping economic development that will bring the three or four billion people on the planet into a measure of prosperity. This strikes me as a really, really urgent problem. So we want, you can see, that the sort of a peer-to-peer exchange of value system could be worked off a cheap mobile phone or a small tablet or a laptop, and that could be instant, that could deal with small payments, would be absolutely a brilliant development. And there is a lot of altruism amongst the geeks who are working on this stuff. At the same time, the money men, including Wall Street, have picked up on the idea that they can kind of do their usual casino economy thing and make some kind of fat profits buying and selling, doing the equivalent of Forex trading. And bear in mind that, you know, Bitcoin, in fact, the top 10 cryptocurrencies rose in value, exchangeable value, in 2017. I mean, that means if you'd have bought £100 worth of the top 10 cryptocurrencies on January the 1st and sold about December before the Black Friday crash, that you'd have made about £40,000 for a £1,000 investment. And of course, you know, these guys think they're doing well if they get 6% or something. So they've had a sniff. And I mean, there are certain kind of, there's definitely froth in the market, bubbles and so forth. I mean, Bitcoin has crashed about four times last year, taking the rest of the cryptocurrencies with it, pretty catastrophically. I think in December it was like 40% wiped off overnight, you know. But the next day it's climbing back up. Now some economists, like Yanis Varoufakis, who I've got a great deal of respect for, just think, I mean, at one point said Bitcoin's a Ponzi scheme. It certainly isn't. He's now moderating his view and saying, well, he admires the technology, but it's definitely overpriced. And I think he's right, from what I understand about these markets. There's a lot of froth. And there's more speculation going on in this sphere, financial speculation, than... I don't know, I nearly said then he's healthy. I mean, I don't think any kind of casino economy is ultimately healthy. But by the same token, the fact that people are trading these currencies and technological innovations, for a start, it enables geeks to launch projects to develop the technology and to build applications of the technology. But at the moment there's more speculation than application. But why this isn't a tulip bubble, as Yanis Varoufakis has said recently, is that, well, tulips, you know, what can you do with tulip bulbs? Well, okay, you can breed them, you can get a black tulip and a blue tulip and blah blah, but that's about it. It's very limited, it has no use value, and also you can't keep a tulip forever. Tulip bulb, it might last a year if you look after it carefully, if you freeze it, or I don't know, we'll chill it down, you might last a couple of years. But eventually it'll rot and become sterile. Whereas what's happening in the cryptosphere is that people are beavering away, and I say very, very bright people in teams are beavering away with quite good funding at their disposal, because they raised cryptocurrency as funds through ICOs and so forth. And beavering away to develop, you know, the kind of thing that can tackle the problem that I mentioned about the lack of financial services in the so-called third world. But many, 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 many other applications, which will make the world a better place and make life more convenient for people and easy for people. And importantly, in many, many cases, cut out the middleman. Cut out the power that's given to banks and financial institutions, which is astronomical and not healthy. You know, the 2008 crash demonstrated just how kind of toxic and malignant finance capital has become in the modern world. And it results in kind of deaths and poverty, gross inequalities of wealth and power, and so on and so on. So this is where Yanis Varoufakis got it a bit wrong, is that there is some kind of use value in the pipeline at least. And I would say that this technology is too powerful to go away. You know, you can't uninvent fire. And the cat's out the bag with all this stuff now. And many of the current cryptocurrencies and projects may well collapse. Some of them are pretty shit. Some of them are opportunistic scams. And the whole thing could collapse overnight. But the technology is going to go away and it will come back. My own prediction there is that we will see crashes, as we have seen. I think there were four last year, you know. Spectacular crashes, because there is a lot of froth. But as the use case comes along, as these developments progress, and obviously, you know, they'll hit snags and there'll be a forward and a back, and there'll be problems and there'll be solutions and there'll be breakthroughs. But as this stuff comes along over the next decades, the speculative element will be proportionally less. And more people will be using the technology to exchange value, to invest, to launch projects, to build things, and to do all kinds of wonderful, innovative things that we haven't yet imagined. So this is where I think is going to go on with this. I mean, I certainly wouldn't, if you get into this speculative mode, but put your shirt on any of this stuff. But it might make sense to buy 100 quid's worth of Cardano or 100 quid's worth of IOTA or something like that. And if you lose it, well, so what? It's a bit like a flutter on a horse, you know. Give up beer for January and put the money into a project that looks useful and viable and that's being executed by clever people. People with the know-how and the skill. Anyway, I think you can see that the question of the role of technological innovation in the unfolding of the human future is an interesting and a big one. And even if you do take the logic of capital view, there's no denying of the enormous role, even if it's not the primordial role, of technological innovation. Anyway, this is something that I think is going to be on my mind for a bit. And I think it can key in quite well with my... I think I've got a kind of fairly broad and fairly comprehensive view of the history of science and the history of ideas. And after the last couple of years, something of a grasp on economic theories and the philosophy of economics. And so I'm going to keep my eye on all this as a kind of paradigm case, I think, really. I suppose the other paradigm case, which might be worth some investigation at some point, is biotechnology and the ability to edit the genome of various organisms, including the human organism, and how this plugs into bioethics and so forth, and into politics. I mean, rumour has it that the Chinese government's busy using the CRISPR technology to produce a perfect worker. You know, so... But by the side of this, of course, we need to weigh the possible impacts of automation. Many economists from all kinds of schools, conservative as well as radical, are of the opinion that by 2030, 50% of jobs, current jobs, will be automated. Again, we have a huge question about how we want this development to go, and what can be done about it. And of course it does plug into the whole question of blockchain and cryptocurrency and so on. I mean, one of the visions is for an Internet of Things, in which machines talk to machines. And in fact, the idea behind one cryptocurrency, which is in development, is called IOTA, is that machines will have wallets and they'll trade with each other. And I can see some kind of good use cases for this, particularly in the sphere of alternative energy, whereby you would have local networks, solar panels and windmills, that would in which the individuals in a local network, which might be like a street or a village, will trade. You know, when you've got a surplus, you'll sell it to somebody who hasn't got a surplus, and vice versa. And when the whole cluster has got a surplus, they sell it to the grid. And when they need to buy some in, they buy it in from the grid. Well, the IOTA idea is that, well, just give the grid, give the microgrid a wallet with a currency and smart contracts, so that all that will be automated, and it'll actually earn some money for the community, perhaps. And of course, make everything very, very efficient. And of course, this is desperately needed. Desperately, desperately needed for the human beings to provide itself with the energy that it needs to live comfortably in a high civilization without destroying the fucking planet. And of course, you know, this is political hot potato. And a matter, I mean, a very, very serious matter of the human survival at all. So, you know, this technology is offering some hope and some purchase on problems of that type. And you can see how this would plug in with automation. I mean, one example that they give is that a driverless car would pull up at a charging station to charge up with electricity, and the car would have its own wallet, and the charging station would have its own wallet, and they would automatically do an exchange, and it would be all invisible to you. And if it's your privately owned car, the car takes you home, and while you're having your dinner, it goes out and picks up some fares and takes them and automatically puts fares into its wallet, so it's earning some money. So, I mean, it's a bit sci-fi, and maybe it's a bit kind of like treating human beings as sport rats, and maybe they should learn to walk again. But nevertheless, you can see how it's pretty well inevitable, and it's already happening, in fact, you know, that machines will talk to machines, and that some of this will be advantageous to human beings in general. For, you know, probably more reasons than I've mentioned. So, may you live in interesting times. I think 2018 is going to be really interesting on this front. And I'm going to carry on keeping my eye on some of these developments as closely as I can, really, within the limit of my energy and expertise. So, anyway, chaps, I'm not so far from Wolverhampton Town Centre now. I hope that's interesting. I have got a few other things in the can, which I can kind of be popping out over the next few days. It's not like I've got a get my skates on to produce loads and loads of podcasts. As I say, I have a few. I've got some need a little bit of editing and so forth. And again, on the usual range of topics. But at the moment, that's what's on my mind is IT, the future, the role of technology in the unfolding of the future, the nature of money, the nature of exchange, and so on and so forth. Anyway, thanks for listening, and Happy New Year, slightly delayed. And may the force be with you.